Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 192, being recorded on the 16th of August, 2017. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Evan. It's just Evan and myself today. Kale, unfortunately, was traveling and couldn't make it in time for the podcast. He's that, you know, the blockchain globetrotter. and as a matter of fact, talking of blockchain, there was that did come up in the news, right? About the Cocoa framework, right, Evan?
It did, yep.
And it was nice to see Mark Rusinovich blog a lot about it. Apparently, this new framework just makes it easier for customers to do blockchain. Because I think, as you probably gathered from previous discussions on our show, it's you know, blockchain can come across as being a little bit esoteric, right? It's just a different way of programming or thinking about distributed computing. Something that we're not used to, and I think what they've tried to do with the Cocoa framework is to kind of boil it down to something that, you know, you and I can probably understand and code to a little easier.
Yeah.
So we definitely we're gonna let unfortunately Kale's not with us today, but we're gonna save the topic for him to talk about hopefully next week on the Cocoa framework. I heard last week the guys did a good job talking about the just-in-time access.
This was actually, if you think about it, Kale's first 100% solo, right? Because Kale and I always laugh once in a while, you'll bail, and then Kale and I have to figure out how to record it and the intro and all that. And Kale was, I mean, he had Russell to help guide him, but this was, I think, his first time doing that part completely solo that I can think of. So he and Jamie and Russell did a bang up job. It was a good show. I listened to it last night on the way home.
They did. Yes, it sounded really good. So you know, normally, Kale, yourself, and me, we normally host the shows, but occasionally we have Russell on, and Russell's in the UK, so his. You know, if we do record a show around 2 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern Standard Time, we'll include Russell, and you know he'll try to join us. But obviously, on a normal time, which is 9:30 p.m. Eastern,
it's a little late for him.
Yeah, he's about 1:30 in the morning there, so he's not going to join us. But last week was good because Jamie was also from the UK, and so he was actually about to leave on vacation before he called it for the show, I believe there was something that you wanted to clarify from that.
So, you know, the whole point, the topic for last week's show was, you know, using the new just-in-time access to kind of dynamically grant and remove the ability to, you know, access FTP or RP in the server, things like that. And I can't remember who made the comment, but there was a statement around, you know, the ability for engineering and support to, you know, access these VMs. Mm-hmm. I think it was something along the lines of in this just-in-time kind of grant similar capabilities. And they didn't, the whoever brought it up didn't say anything wrong, but I did want to make sure that we were really clear on it because this is something that there's both confusion and concern about it, right? I used to support, you know, when we first released IaaS and we originally had PaaS, we would get the occasional case where the customer said, you know, something's going wrong with my VM, I can't get into it. You know, I want you to remote into it and fix it, right? I messed up sysprep, right? So I want you to go in and sysprep's sitting there just asking for, you know, what time zone do you want? And if you do that, you're done and it'll do the rest of it. Right. And customers would say, hey, you told me that, great, can you fix it for me? Or hey, I've screwed up my Linux VM, can you go in and, you know, and change the config file so it'll reboot? We do not have that capability at all whatsoever, either in support or engineering. So we do have the ability to access the hosts, right? That's how we get, you know, traditionally we've gotten network traces that way. We're getting we're actually putting in more and more capability to push us further away from that kind of direct access. But we do have that capability. But at the end of the day, you still don't have credentials for that virtual machine.
Yep.
So even if we, you know, had the ability to remote into the host and have a full console session, we can't get into the VMs. The most we can ever see is the same thing you would see if you walk up to a machine that's locked.
Right.
Right. You see the control alt delete scheme, and you might see a no boot, you know, case. But, you know, again, if your machine's in a total no boot, can't fix it anyway.
Now, couldn't you use that boot logging or that? I remember there was a feature where you could see the boot screen.
For Linux, you can definitely do the console logs. And
console
then,
log. Yeah.
I think we just released the ability to see. 4 or 5 months ago, just released the ability to see screenshots from
That's what I'm
Windows
talking about.
VMs as well. Yeah. And that was basically the capability that we had internally for a long time, right? We could see that stuff. Now, for PaaS VMs, there is a way, because the PaaS VMs runs a guest agent, to do that. I can count on, like, one hand the number of times that we've done it, and we have a really strict process where that we actually are showing the customer what we're doing. We're actually sharing our screen with the customer, and you know it, but we really, I mean, I'm literally can count finger count of the number of times I'm aware that we've ever done that, even in PaaS. Because it, and the only reason we ever would consider it in PaaS, even historically, is because PaaS, there's no state information,
right?
So I can't do anything to screw up your server. You just spin up a new cloud service instance, and we're good. It was really around trying to figure out why that was, trying to get memory dumps from when those wouldn't start. Now we have the ability to do that, you know, from the platform, so there's no reason to do that. So yeah, I actually have had a couple of times where, you know, an engineer kind of told the customer that they could go do it, and they were trying to figure it out and build some really convoluted process, and I've had to a couple times come in and say, nope, stop, that's like, we don't have the capability. Even if we did, I don't want it. Like, I don't want that liability.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I like my job, right? So, but yeah, so I just wanted to make it clear to everybody in the audience, right? That is, while conceptually the ability is there, we do the OC console stuff, we don't have creds. There's no way for me to create credentials in these machines. And really, even if we did, we don't want it. So that is something we cannot do.
Good. I'm glad you clarified that. So let's get on to our updates. We got a few, not too many, maybe three or four to talk about today. I'll start with one. And this was related to the Azure Site Recovery. This has now been extended to support replication out of a particular data center into another data center within the region, or inside of another region as well. Now, just to be clear, you can't just say, I want to replicate from, I don't know, US East to Australia South or whatever is over there. Okay. There's still some notion of a geographical cluster that keeps some of these regions close by, right? Like, for example, North and South America, obviously, you know, that's one cluster. And then you have Asia, which, you know, involves India and Southeast Asia, Japan, Korea, etc. And then similarly, UK is one and Australia is one. So, as you know, you can still replicate to other regions, but they have to be within this geographic cluster. They can't just be, you know, across the oceans.
So basically, you get a list of ones you can do it to, and you can pick whatever you want. But beyond that, there's no config.
There's no config. Yeah, it's all automatic, and now, you know, you're protecting yourself for something. If, you know, hopefully something, it doesn't happen, but in case something bad does happen to a big region, for example.
I thought that was really cool.
That is cool. And then so I noticed they've got some updates in the SQL space as well.
I actually didn't, it makes sense in hindsight, but I had forgotten that this was not available in Azure SQL DB, which is global temporary tables. Right, so if you do the pound table name, right, in an on-premises, I now have a temporary table that's global across multiple queries. But the way that Azure SQL DB was implemented, you didn't have that ability. We actually blocked that.
Right.
So we've now shipped that as preview, public preview for Azure SQL DB. And, you know, anybody who's done on-premises stuff, that's, you know, something they're very, very familiar with. But again, it's yet another kind of capability from that we're now lighting up in the Azure SQL DB space that just mimics existing functionality on-premises.
Oh. Nice. Yeah, yes. Nice to see them constantly putting out those
Yeah.
updates. So there was an interesting update on the Azure CDN space, and we're going to have to get some more information on this because this is almost too good to be true kind of scenario here. But Azure CDN is typically used to take information that is cacheable and cache it very close to the where the user is. Right, within the world, wherever they're accessing that information from. But the question has always been, what do you do with information that is not cacheable? Right, like your credentials or social media information and things like that. And if you still want to have some, you want to push that out as close to users, what do you do? And so there's this new concept called the Dynamic Site Accelerator that's been introduced in Azure CDN, and it claims to do just that, improves the performance of your page loads, gives you a better user experience, also, which finally gives you a better conversion rate, which is very important for e-commerce sites. And they've got some very simple pricing model. It's just, based on the number of terabytes a month that you consume globally. And really just, click a button. There's a bunch of scenarios you can pick from the portal, and you're good to go. So I'm, like, as a developer, I'm very curious about this. And, unfortunately, I haven't really gotten a good understanding as to how it works under the covers. I'm curious to know how it does work. So I'll get some more information on this, and we'll talk about it again next week.
Yeah, no, I think your point. I mean, it does sound too good to be true. I have my dynamic content set up just like my static stuff. So, yeah. The other thing that I wanted to mention was, we just announced the Azure Event Grid, and this is again, this is another thing that I think we're going to have to go play with and do some and find somebody to come on and talk about, because this goes hand in hand with all the serverless stuff we talked about, right? Function apps and or Azure Functions and Logic Apps, but now you can kick off this serverless code by keying off events for other things, right? So my VM goes up, my VM goes down, right? All that stuff triggers events, and now you can trigger this other stuff. Now you really have a true serverless both generation of the events, right? You don't have to write any code for these events to get generated, and then you can consume them with no infrastructure either. Right, really, really kind of neat. This sounds like, if we could integrate this with something like Flow and some of this other stuff, right? Man, the possibilities are endless.
And I like what was mentioned in the in there was using Azure Automation, right? Because often Azure Automation is used to detect some of these situations, and then when that happens, you want a bunch of things to happen, right? You want to fail over this site. You want to start, copying over some files somewhere else, and you want to do a lot of things at the same time, and so this allows you to trigger all those events in different in different Azure functions or Logic App applications that you have out there, and do all that just in reacting to this in real time. So I think it's really nice, and the fact that you don't have to deploy any code. It's this is all serverless. There's no instance to deploy. It's just gets called whenever the event happens. So very nice. Yeah, I like this. True. I did catch wind of it early today, and we're actually thinking about it for our customer as well. So I'm sure we'll learn more about this as the weeks go by. So let's get then. Let's start talk about some stuff today. Oh, so before we get started on some of the stuff we want to talk about this episode, one of our Twitter followers reached out to us, and he actually he was I hope I say his name correctly, Christian Forhan. I'm sure I didn't pronounce his last name correctly, but he reached out to us on Twitter. He's having a interesting problem with Dev Test Labs, and I think he just said, "Hey, maybe you guys can help us out." And we did look into it, and we do promise to have some more information for him and for our listeners, hopefully by the next week. I think we'll have to send this up the chain, so to speak, to the product group and see what they have to say about it. Because at least in our own investigation, there didn't seem to be an easy way to do this. And just kind of quick summary. Essentially, the Devtest Labs has this concept of artifacts. Artifacts are kind of like scripts and installation files that get deployed onto your VMs, right? That make up your lab. And so, when the lab is created, when the VM is created, it runs these artifacts automatically. It's sort of like as you mentioned, Evan, earlier, sort of like the DSC extensions or things that get installed on a regular VM. The question, the thing is that if one of these MSIs that are getting installed as part of these artifacts requires the machine to reboot, apparently the script that's running as part of the artifact doesn't get a chance to finish up because it seems like that MSI then just immediately tries to reboot the machine, which leaves that script in an unfinished state. And so the question I believe was from Kristen was, is there any way to stop the machine from rebooting or delay it? And we couldn't find any way to do that just using any available commands. As a matter of fact, we did find some documentation online that says, as far as possible, whenever you install these kind of MSIs, which could cause a potential reboot, you want to try and force the MSI not to reboot the machine. And then after you're done with your script, you manually force a reboot using some sort of PowerShell command, I suppose. So that's the recommended practice, but I suppose that's not always possible, and that's
Yeah,
probably
the one
why.
thing that did occur to me while we were talking about this is you could, and I'd have to go test to see if this could be done, but if you think about DSC, right? DSC is all about repeating the DSC script until everything is right. You could theoretically, I guess, do a little bit of a custom DSC that says, "Hey, if this file exists, i.e., my stuff is installed, then don't do the MSI. If the file is not there, then run the MSI." But because of the way DSC always goes through and checks your state, your desired config, right? Every time it starts up and every so often, that might handle the, "Hey, I need to do the reboot, but still come back and do more stuff." But yeah, we'll have to do some digging and go see. I don't know the answer. I'm sorry.
Well, let's see if we can reach out to the product team and see what they have to say, and we'll get back to Kristen on the next episode.
Yep, hopefully. Yep.
Right. So you had some good ideas about what to talk about today. Something to
Yeah. So, I mean, we once in a while we come back and do kind of this making it real stuff, right? And it occurred to me as we were talking about what we want to talk about this week that, even in both my personal life and in my professional life, I've found over, I've used Azure capabilities a ton over the last, 6 to 9 months or whatever, even the last couple 3 weeks. And I thought it'd be, and I know Sujeet, you do both personal development and, professional development. I thought it'd be neat to kind of share with the audience the kind of the different things we're doing and what features we're running, just to kind of, it's not just this theoretical stuff out there, right? This is real things that we're doing with it as well.
That's right. Yeah. And just because there's so many Azure services that are out there, if you really sit down with the entire catalog of services, I bet you're going to find something that you can say, aha, I can use that today, right? It's just a matter of, we forget, right, what's out there because there's so many services out there. And so as we're listening to podcasts or looking at listening to other people talking, I'm like, hey, wait a minute, I forgot about that thing and I can use it over here,
Yeah.
And then
Well,
so
why
go
don't you
ahead.
go first, Ajit? I mean, what's something you've done, I guess, doing on the personal side first?
So on the personal side, the cognitive services is something that I've been using a lot. That's something that I'm very excited about, especially trying to take social media, right, like Twitter feeds and things like that, and I'm trying to come up with a way to analyze what they're saying because cognitive services can give you the sentiment off the Twitter feed, right? So if you take some of the, let's say, the most popular Twitter feeds, like a good example was the one like Obama tweeted that thing recently and it became the most liked tweet. So if you take that tweet and you try to analyze it, it'll kind of give you a good indication. The cognitive services can tell you like, okay, this is a very serious sentiment or a very happy sentiment or or whatever. And so I think that's a very exciting, interesting thing because then if you try to kind of keep doing this over a period of time, you start building this very interesting database, right, of how The most popular tweets are flowing as it relates to sentiment.
Interesting.
Like, is it like, is the general population like, happy, or are they all, not happy, or maybe they don't care, or whatever it is, it kind of, so I'm trying to kind of, create some app to figure that out. So that's something that I've been doing it with cognitive services, which definitely recommend. There's so many of them, right? I mean, I'd mentioned tweets, but you can even images. You can do the same thing with images from Instagram, for example, and then run it through the cognitive services. It'll scan the image and it'll extract all the text from it, and it'll do the same thing. You can run a sentiment analysis on that as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, you think about like the amount of code and effort you'd have to put into doing that sentiment analysis a couple, 3 years ago, right on your own. Forget it, right? You wouldn't even come anywhere near it. You'd just throw that project in the trash, right?
I mean, it wouldn't even be accurate, and it would take too long to do.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
So for on my side, so this is on the personal side. So I do, I have a media server for my family at home. And up until maybe 6 or 7 months ago, this was running in the closet. And whenever, I'd have a drive failure, I'd have a, have to go in and update something or whatever, I'd have to pull stuff out of the closet and hook up the monitor and hook up the keyboard. And because, sometimes I could RDP do it, but not everything can be done over an RDP session, right? Not for kind of my low end stuff. And I finally got tired of doing that. And so I moved the entire thing to Azure. It's running as an Azure IaaS VM. And I've been doing that for a while and it works fantastic, right?
So
I
your whole
don't have
media
any.
services in the cloud now?
Well, I've got basically a media server for some of our own, our pictures and those
Right,
kind of
right,
things,
right.
right? So it's just a standard VM, right? It's got some software laying on top of it that's got a public front end that, basically a website, or a web front end that my family can go to get our pictures and manage our stuff. This was some of this kind of pre-exists, and we got family videos and all that kind of stuff in it. I mean, we could put this stuff in OneDrive, but then we wouldn't be able to play them necessarily,
Right.
right? And so we do all that, which is great, and it works great to just lift and shift it. But I started, as we started having all these different VM sizes, and I was starting to, want to get a little fancier about, in the middle of the day when my family's not around, why am I paying for, an A3, right, or whatever sizes is. And and then in the afternoon and the weekends when, my parents might be trying to look at stuff or my family is, right, I'm home, I want a slightly faster machine, right? And so I went in and built an Azure automation script that, just based on the time of day, it sends in a different parameter and it sizes it up and sizes it down and it kind of really optimizes my use around the kind of the way my family uses it. And this will save me some money over the long run. And it was just, I didn't realize how powerful Azure Automation was in terms of the ability to schedule things and build, parameterized stuff. And it's just straight PowerShell,
Nice.
right? So it's really just like a PowerShell script that I would have written historically and, had running on a server in my house to call this other server. Well, now I don't have either. I have Azure Automation for this automated scripting, and I have the IaaS VM for, the functionality, and now there is one less thing sitting in my house, chewing up electricity and taking up space.
That's nice, yeah, and it's not hopefully not going to crash anytime soon. Like the hard disk is not going to break or something like that, because that's what happens to these old machines eventually, they die.
Well, and I don't know about you, but I always buy my stuff like second or third hand in the office anyway, so.
And and since you mentioned it, like Azure Automation just occurred to me. That's like almost like another form of serverless computing, right?
It
That we
is,
have.
yeah.
I never thought about it that way, but now that you mentioned it, yes. So we have functions, we have logic apps, which we talked about earlier, and then we have Azure Automation. That's great. That's really good. So yeah, I want to talk about one thing that we're doing at with my customer. I'm a MCS consultant, so we primarily help our customers use Azure to the fullest possible extent, right? Solve all their business problems. And my customers are the financial services, very large customer, and they've been using the cloud services, okay, the traditional cloud services for a very long time. And No, we've obviously tried to go in and say, okay, what are the, should they move off cloud services? That's always been the question, right? Because,
You're saying the traditional web roles and
the web
worker
role
roles.
and worker role and things like that, right? That's how Azure was started, right? Let's put it that way, way back when. So, and it still exists. And, so we've gone through various iterations, planning to try and figure out what else can, what are the other newer platforms or services that can be used, PaaS services we can use to migrate some of this workload off. And of course, we've talked about app services, right, which became a fairly straightforward thing because it's essentially ASP.NET, and you can just take that and move it over for the most part. We've talked about Service Fabric, but that requires a lot of
Oh,
rework.
you know you want to do Service Fabric. That's where you're
I
pushing.
definitely want to do Service Fabric, but then it does require a lot of changes because it's a different programming paradigm. There's no IIS and things like that. And then we have containers, right? Running Windows containers, which is just a, so we've looked at all three of these, and all three of these have some pros and cons, okay? But the kind of point that we always go back to is that cloud services run so well, right?
They do.
I think we all came to the conclusion that that is like the ultimate PaaS platform, okay? There's no other, unfortunately, none of the newer platforms come close to being as good as being PaaS compared to cloud services. I mean, it is really bulletproof, right? It runs, the SLAs are really good. It has that, application model where you can just say, hey, here's my app, go run it, right? I don't really care about anything else. And at the same time, if you do need to do additional things, it has, like you mentioned earlier, it has the startup tasks, right? That you can do things like enterprises want to do, inject certain things into the VMs that are running the cloud service, for example, putting special antivirus software or running some special scripts, partial scripts to do custom things that are specific to the enterprise, and they can do that. Right, so you can kind of have your cake and eat it too with the cloud services. It gives you that complete. The developer thinks they get this great, application model where they just push stuff, and they got these web roles and worker role models which fit 99% of all scenarios basically. So they're very happy. It scales up and scales down on demand. It's got the update domains, the fault domains, everything that somebody would want. Right, and so the question is like, why should these people not stay on cloud services forever? Right, why shouldn't they just stay on cloud
It's a
services?
reasonable question.
Yeah, and I'm sure you get that too sometimes. If people probably call and say like, hey, I've been on this for a while, should I really move off it? So, what are some of the reasons you may want to move off it? I mean, I think we've made it clear before that Microsoft isn't going to deprecate cloud services anytime soon. Okay, that's going to be something because internally as well, we use cloud services for a number of our,
None.
for a number of our services. I think, and I'm sure, Xbox, Skype, etc., have all been
Azure VPN
Azure.
is exactly what you were talking about. We're moving away from this as an implementation, but the original implementation is Windows RS running on worker roles.
Yeah. There you go.
Absolutely. That's not going away anywhere soon.
Yep. And so this is going to be around for a while. So the but at the same time, some of the newer enhancements like ARM, right? ARM. We lose all of that ARM goodness. We have to kind of, if you want to automate something within cloud services, you have to use the old ASM programming model, which is good, but it's not that declarative model that we've come to love in ARM. We also don't get the chance to use things like managed disks, right? These are some of the like a lot of the newer services have that flexibility of having an update domain and fault domain within storage as well, which they cannot take advantage of. And so this is some of the I guess some of the few reasons why people may want to move off it. So it's kind of a tussle, right? What do you want more? You do. I mean, I don't know what if you've heard anything.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's the way to think about it. As you were listing that stuff, the other thing that comes to my mind is I actually, in the on-premises world, I really, really try hard to convince customers to not do that, right? To not take some server deployment they've got and just say, hey, we're just going to put it in the corner. Nobody touch it. It's just going to run forever. Because the reality is the hardware will fail at some point, or, you'll go to log into it one day and, it just, it won't boot. I mean, whatever, right? Windows Update comes in and makes a small change. It's not as static as you think, right? But the biggest challenge with that stuff, right, is the hardware, right? Sometimes the hardware's out of support. You can't get it. Some of these things now that we deploy into the cloud, you're abstracted from the hardware. So unless you need some of these new functionality that you're talking about, right, if this thing is out there and it's running and it's doing great, I think part of the move to, as a service stuff, it really says, you know what, if it's working for you, there is no incentive necessarily to change it. Why take that extra cost and effort, right, if you really don't need the latest and greatest?
And if I were to think of typical Microsoft support lifecycle, right? The only thing that's going to come in the way, I think, is the fact, I think somewhere around the year 2022, right? When that'll be 10 years since Windows Server 2012 has been installed, which is the base operating system for the cloud services. And then we get into this area where, okay, now it's out of mainstream support. You know how 10 years is that magic number, and then beyond that, they have special support and things like that. So at that point, they're going to have to make a decision whether they want to upgrade the operating system for cloud services to, say, 2016 or something newer, or make some decision. And so I believe that at that 2022 is when, someone's going to have to look at this a little harder at themselves.
But you know what? I mean, that it's kind of ironic if you think about it, because realistically, the odds of many applications staying, because I think if you're doing new code, if you're doing new development, right, your new features in your app, you're probably going to leverage some of the new capabilities,
Correct.
right, new armor on.
That's a
But
very good
like,
point.
I can count, I don't know if I have any fingers that I can count on, the number of apps that I know that have been running for, 10 or 12 years with not a single change. Right, I mean, there's probably some out there. I no question. I'm sure we'll get flooded with people telling us that. But I think 2022 is far enough away that, just put that decision off, I
Well, the thing
think.
is, these are enterprises that have big applications, right?
Agreed.
And they're not changing, they normally make incremental changes. So this is not something where they can say, oh, we're going to just, cut the block right here and do something brand new. That takes a lot of planning, right, to do
It
something
does.
like that.
It does. So, but yeah, I think the dynamics have certainly changed, right, from where they used to be, right? I'd say that my recommendation to people would be, right, be looking for when you do new stuff, that incremental, right? Figure out some way to start slowly moving pieces over. But I don't think it's anything like, in the on-premises world, well, man, we got to get this off because this hardware goes out of warranty next month, right? It's totally different from that side. So. Yep, no, good. Definitely have heard that question lots.
What do you got?
I actually own a couple of applications internally that CSS uses to kind of manage our business. And one of them, we've actually it's actually a little scary how much Azure stuff we now layered in. In the last couple of months, we've done some significant develop to this tool. We've moved it to a VSO. Implementation from, kind of from an on-premises source control. We have done full integration with Application Insights. We now, all of our telemetry, all of our data is now going in there, and we do our Power BI reports directly against that instead of kind of this ad hoc, SQIM database that was running the app before. We are getting ready to do a multi-master, multiple distributed read, single write database architecture, and we're doing it by, we're slowly, right now we're using DataSync to synchronize our on-premises database to our Azure database because some of our end users are not on our corporate network, so we can't leverage 100% on-premises. And we're going to expand that out worldwide so that we have copies of this database all around the world. And, you know, I sat down and wrote an ARM plus, you know, PowerShell, I'm sorry, an ARM template plus some other PowerShell to create these resources worldwide. So I just have to pick a region. It, you know, deploys all the resources we need in every region. It really is. I mean, like, I never could have done this kind of thing several years ago without standing up a bunch of IIS servers and trying to figure out where I host them. And, you know, and it's not easy to do, right? And now it's just like, oh, yeah, I sat down for like 2 days and I had the code written to deploy these worldwide resources. And you know, I didn't have to worry anything about it. It was really the hard part was figuring out the logic to get how did we want to design it and what resources do we need in each region. But once we figured out what we wanted, figuring out how to get them deployed was just a matter of writing the right ARM template and 3 or 4 lines of PowerShell and, you know, tying it all together and we're done.
Right. Yeah. And what's the approach you take? You normally go to the GitHub repo and look for existing ARM templates, or do you'll reverse engineer it from the portal?
It's kind of a mix. You know, I'm actually kicking myself because one of the parts of this is some one of the challenges with multi-master, right, is figuring out which is the quote-unquote closest data center for an end user. So what I decided to do was I dumped a static text file in a storage account, and then I wrote some code that goes and hits every single deployment we have, and then it kind of aggregates the responses. It does it a couple, three times, and then says, "Hey, I consistently see a faster response from this data center. I'm going to call this my closest." I did that with PowerShell to deploy those resources. In hindsight, I'm kicking myself for not doing an ARM template. So when I got to the SQL Azure and the part of it, I deployed my SQL Azure instance as an ARM template. Because that just was easier. So it was nice because I could kind of mix or match right as I was going along. And I took the ARM template straight from the portal. That was what kind of I was in the portal doing something. Went, oh crap! There's that automation. I think automation script
just
button
tab.
Right in the portal. I was like, well, why don't I just use that? Cut, paste, done. There's my ARM template. You know, and the rest of the code, you know, I did. I went back to some PowerShell for the sync stuff. But it was, you know, really nice to be able to kind of take those pieces where I could get them and still very easily tie a globally distributed solution together with minimal effort.
That's amazing. Good story. Very good story. Yeah, I'm sure we could go on and on in this over here, Evan.
Yeah, I could probably go all night.
I just wanted to just take a minute just to mention a couple of things real quick that I think I just, you know, we talked about Cosmos DB, and for sure
Yes.
that's another area that I've been playing around with a lot. I mean, totally impressed with the service. We had the product team over for a boot camp recently in DC, and I attended that, and I mean, just all the more impressed with that service now. And made it my goal that any application I build from now on, and I am building some of these cognitive services, one that talked about the back end is all Cosmos DB. So that's got to be it. I mean, you have to think of why not Cosmos DB. That's the only question you need to ask for any application these days. You know, start with Cosmos DB. If for some reason you can't do it, then you look at other options, maybe SQL Server or something else. But you got to start with Cosmos DB, I believe. And the container stuff is also pretty cool. You know, like I was talking about how we took some of those cloud services. I just took the code and I, you know, just put it into a Docker container running in Azure in Service Fabric, no less. And it just ran. You know, I didn't have to make any code changes. So that's another path, you know, that people can look at is take existing cloud services and run them in a Windows Server container. That's really nicely how that all works. Cool. Anything else you want to add before we wrap up? I know I had a bit of a long show today.
No, I you know, as always, you know, I mean, keep there's like I think you said it earlier in the show. You know, if you're sitting down to write some code, I think this is my strongest guidance I can give anybody. If you're sitting down to write some code, take a couple minutes and look on
Think again.
Azure and see if it's there because I bet you're going to find something that you go, you know what, that piece of my code I don't have to write. I'm going to leverage that service And then I'm just going to have one less piece of my code that I have to maintain.
Yeah, and from a cost perspective, these things, don't cost a whole lot, right? The cost of writing your
No.
own code and maintaining it is far greater than what it costs to use some of these services.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, this has been a good discussion. Thank you for a good idea, Evan. Have a good evening, and hopefully we'll get Kale next week, and we'll talk about that Cocoa stuff.
Yeah, we got to get our dose of blockchain back,
Yeah,
right? So,
absolutely.
sounds
All right.
good.
Look
See
forward
ya.
to talking to you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.